Tens of thousands of international students study at universities all across the state, and the recent kidnapping of a researcher from China at the University of Illinois has some parents worried about safety. We'll hear from two Illinois colleges about what they're doing to help international students feel safe and supported when they come to campus. Plus, what's it like to graduate from high school with 2 years of college already under your belt?
For many students, they want to get a jump start on college. Some students we hear, they don't feel they're being challenged at their high school as much as they would like. So we felt that we could help fill that need for a select group of students.
More than 300 high school students in Illinois are taking college classes to get an associate's degree thanks to a program called Running Start. And we'll revisit our conversation with comedian Jeremy McClellan on making a career in the space where politics and comedy collide.
No one is like, I really agree with you, but just stick to being funny. But how I am funny is pointing out the absurdities in politics and, you know, these big hot button issues.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. You know, parents often worry about their students when they go off to college. That's especially true when the college happens to be in another country. Recent events have heightened some of those concerns across Illinois. Ying-Ying Zhang, researcher from China, was abducted from the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. A suspect has been charged, but police and the FBI believe that the victim is dead. Many international families, especially from China, have been paying attention to this case. Say they're worried about safety. All across Illinois, tens of thousands of international students study at the colleges and universities in the state, most at the University of Illinois' Urbana campus, but also Chicago, Bloomington Normal, Springfield, DeKalb, other towns across the state. So what are campuses doing to make sure international students feel not only safe, but also welcome and supported when they arrive on campus? Josh Furshow, Director of International Student Services at Knox College, is with us. Also, Yimin Wong, Associate Director of International Studies and Programs at Illinois State University in Bloomington Normal. Join us here on the line. Thank you both. Welcome to the 21st.
Yeah, thanks so much, Scott. It's great to be with you.
Hi, this is Yimin. Thank you for having us.
No, of course. I appreciate the time here. I mean, Yimin, let's start with you. I mean, there's still a lot we don't know about this case here in Urbana, the Ying-Ying Zhang case, but it's been getting attention across the state, around the world. I mean, you're not that far away there in Bloomington Normal. When you heard about this, what did you tell your students? What are you hearing from them?
Well, that's a good question, because Ying-Ying Zhang's very tragic case certainly had a lot of media attention. Of course, I think all international students, especially Chinese students and their parents, know about the case. The whole town and campus, even at Illinois State University, 1 hour's drive away from Urbana-Champaign, are very saddened by this specific case. Well, at your intro part, I think you mentioned about what the universities do for not only to ensure student safety, but also to make them feel welcome.
Yeah, and supported, yeah.
Supported and well engaged on campus. Like for Illinois State University, we always do 2-day-long welcome and orientation. As soon as they arrive on campus, we bring them to Walmart and do the campus tour and do mm-hmm. the town tour, so make them well-oriented.
So the geography, so you know where you are
and
what's around
yes.
the community.
Right. And this year specifically, we start to have the airport assistance from August 1st to August 14th in Chicago O'Hare Airport. So as soon as they get off the airplane at the terminal, they will see our staff members with our flag there. So they will feel very welcome
yeah.
and feel safe and be engaged part of university.
Right from that moment when they get off the planes and land at the airport, they know right where to go and that the university is represented right there.
Right, and they know who that staff member is, and then the plans with the university start right from there.
Okay.
But there's also another question about how students feel about whether it is safe.
Yeah, and that kind of gets to this case, and we hear, you know, perceptions are very different all around the world. I mean, you know, Chicago in some parts of the world right now is known for its gun violence. So we do hear sometimes from parents, from students, just, you know, that... Well, I guess let me bring it back to that. I mean, are you hearing concerns right now from parents about safety, you know, fair or not, when students might be coming to Illinois?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. Specifically, actually now on campus, we're hosting a group of 27 students from Southwest University, China. The incidents happened right after they purchased their air ticket. So I started to receive phone calls from parents and from students about whether they should really come or not, even only for 3 weeks or for a month. Of course, I also received inquiries from degree-seeking students. We had conversations with their parents. It is a very tough question to answer whether it is safe or not. You know,
right, yeah. I mean, how did you find that? Yeah.
Of course, we have a lot of conversations on campus about this, but specifically for Chinese students, I would always let them compare with their hometown. For example, this group from Chongqing. I would say, you know, I'm Chinese too, so I'm from China. I won't do whatever that I'm not supposed to do in Chongqing. You know, there are safety issues. There are safety issues everywhere in the world. Ever since we were very young, our parents and our teachers taught us to follow certain rules and keep yourself and your friends safe, no matter where you go. Especially when you come to a new place, you should be mindful of some of these rules. But it doesn't mean that you should be really nervous or your parents should be really nervous. And I especially remind students to always keep good contact with their parents, because being that far away, your parents can be really concerned of your safety and your engagement, your both academic engagement and your life here. So having that communications open, and whenever you feel some kind of concerns or if you have some kind of concerns, always come to talk with us, because a lot of cases are very individual depending on where you stay on campus, off campus, how late in the night you need to go back home, that kind of thing. So I would say it's the cases of the concerns sometimes can be individual, but I would always have a conversation with them comparing the safety standard and also the measures you would take safety-wise in your hometown.
Yeah, and comparing it to their hometown. I mean, that's an interesting thought. We've talked a lot about sort of safety here, and I think that makes sense in the context of some of these other things that we've been talking about. But I mean, Josh, I want to bring you a little bit in here. So Josh Fursho is at Knox College, a slightly different environment, a smaller school than the U of I or Illinois State. But, you know, the school year here is starting in a month or two, depending on the schedule. Josh, when an international student arrives on campus there at Knox, you know, people come from many different places. You know, what are some of the most important things about living in the U.S. that you want to make sure you help students with in their very few days and weeks that they're on campus?
Yeah, Knox is, like you said, a bit different. We are quite small, and we are a fully residential college, so our students are going to be making their home on campus with us in addition to studying while they're there. So we think it's really important to greet students and help them to feel really welcome when they come to the college. Like at ISU, we work to meet students at whatever their point of entry is into the state, greet them at the airport or the train station if that's the way they're coming. And then we run an orientation program to help the students really overcome any of the bureaucratic obstacles that might exist, everything from dealing with Social Security and getting any visa issues that might arise, opening a bank account, getting their cell phones set up so that they can really do the things that they've come to Knox to do, which is to study and to learn about other people and cultures from different places in the world.
And then in terms of, so that's a lot of the logistics and the help, and that support is, I'm sure, appreciated a lot. So what about in terms of the community? What sort of support is there to help people are coming into it? You've got people from all over the state, from the country, from the world, coming to this place, you know, for the first time away at school, even if they're just from down the road, you know, oftentimes coming to college for the first time. You know, what are those conversations like? What sort of support is there as they come into a brand new place for the first time, just to try to get a sense of, you know, what's there and what's expected?
Yeah, and we really want to build a community. And like you say, our students are coming from all over the United States and all over the world. And because our students are living on campus, we really try to very quickly integrate the international students into both the communities of students that are on campus and also into the greater Galesburg community, which is where Knox is located. We have a family friendship program. It's like a host family program, but it's not residential. The students still live on campus, but they have kind of this bridge into to Galesburg, a family that will introduce them to different parts of American culture, taking them out to movies, having them over for dinner. They get to see something a bit more about what American family life might be like, and contrast that with what's happening on campus and what might exist in their hometown. But we do think that it is really essential to form a community. We really, I don't think that there's any experience more transformative to a student, or that really helps you even understand yourself or the world better than studying abroad. And I really admire the students' independence and sense of adventure to even want to come to the United States for their 4 years of undergraduate education.
Yeah. That's an interesting, but you sort of those more mundane type things, that, for lack of a better term, that you're talking about there. And I wonder, Eamon, coming back to you, there at the Illinois State University, what do you hear from students? Are there some specific American cultural norms that seem, unusual to people who are moving here for the first time?
Well, it depends on where you're from. For example, when we talk about classroom cultures, we just had a workshop for faculty members about how international students adjust to American classroom culture, which is also part of our international student orientation. So it's more of a two-way street. We have trainings for faculty members of how to accommodate international students, but also international students how to accommodate American classrooms.
And that's a good point. That's an important point, is that campus has a responsibility. All the campuses have a responsibility to the students. You're not just saying students come here and learn the culture and the community, but the campus is here to support you and to build a climate where you can do your best work.
Right, exactly. So just to give you an example, for students from some part of East Asia, for example, China, the place I'm most familiar of, in American classroom, the professors would normally say, what do you think of it? But in China, the professors would say, hey, so-and-so, what do you think of it? Right?
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to get that that pattern of communication and find that moment to express yourself.
And when to respond and how to respond.
Right.
And...
Yeah, and how to follow up with other peer students and also the professor. So that can take some time for students to get used to.
And how do you handle that? Do you just sort of brief the students that this is how it is? Do you talk with the professors, a little bit of both?
Right, a little bit of both. At the orientation, we invite some experienced faculty members to let students know this is the expectation of American classrooms and try to speak up. And at the faculty workshops, what we talk about is, in some parts of the world, students are a little reluctant to express themselves because they are trained differently, the cultures are differently, cultures are different. So maybe allow a little bit more time, or if you really know the students well, at some point you can have a conversation with students and whether it is okay just to point to that student or encourage students to speak up. So, it is a two-way street. And I would say most of our international students, they learn how to communicate rather quickly after they figure out. Of course, there is always some, most of the times there are some language barriers, but once they overcome that, communication in the classrooms, especially with the support from our faculty members, can be accommodated, I would say, after half a semester or a semester, depending on where you are, whether you're an undergraduate student, graduate student, or PhD student. But I think that initial education and communication is very important.
Yeah, and being immersed, helps too. We're that immersed in a culture, whatever the culture might be or whatever the country is, that can move happen fairly fast. Yimin Wong, the voice there, Associate Director of Office of International Studies and Programs at Illinois State University. Also online, Josh Fershow, Director of International Student Services at Knox College. Josh, coming back to you for a minute. You're in Galesburg town, I think, about 30,000 people or so, roughly an hour south of the Quad Cities area. Are there any misconceptions that people have when they come from another country into your town, into your campus?
I think certainly. I think, you're asking about kind of surprises that international students might have or observations they make about the United States generally. And I think one is how spread out everything is and how low the population density is in our country in general. I think a lot of students come to a lot of our towns in colleges in Illinois thinking they've heard of Chicago, but don't know a lot more about the geography.
Mm-hmm.
And, when they know that it's a 2.5 hour train ride from Chicago to Galesburg, but they don't expect they're going to see so much corn and soybeans on their way on that train ride. And because you pretty quickly leave Chicago before you've arrived into Galesburg, there's not suburban development the whole way. And but I think that students are also surprised to find that they are really welcomed, that the people of Galesburg are really excited to learn more about their culture and where they're from. And that there sometimes is a lot of confusion, and I think some students too are surprised by the lack of understanding of world affairs that a lot of Americans seem to have, given that they've spent so much of their lives studying American culture and American history, and wanting to come here and then get here and realize that many people don't have any sense of where they're coming from or what their life is like, or maybe even how similar in many ways their life had been before coming to the U.S.
Before coming here. Just one, we've only got 10 seconds here, but I wonder, is there one thing maybe, Eamon, as we wrap up, for those who've never studied or lived in another country, you know, again, just in about 10 seconds here, you know, what do you want them to know about what that's like?
For people who have never studied outside of the country, I would say it takes a lot of courage, and it is adventurous, but it's a very courageous experience. I would agree with Josh. It is transformative. You learn a lot of new things. Your horizon will be expanded. Initially, you might experience some challenges, but it's a learning experience.
And I also heard Josh say,
very positively.
I heard Josh say also that, you know, he encourages other people to, you know, from the United States students to go and travel abroad too. To grow. So the voice of Eamon Wong there, Associate Director, Office of International Studies and Programs at Illinois State University. Also Josh Frischow, Director of International Student Services at Knox College. Some perspectives there from a couple of campuses around the state. I should also say we did invite somebody from the University of Illinois at Urbana to come on the show today. We're not able to make that happen. But a good conversation here about adjusting to U.S. college life. Thank you both for joining us here on the 21st.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. You know, for years, high school students have been able to get a head start on college courses, advanced placement classes, and others give college credit. But there's a program in Southern Illinois that's enrolling high school students in college during their last 2 years of school. They can earn a high school diploma and associate's degree at the same time. It's called Running Start, and Emily Larner is one of the students in that program. She finished her sophomore year at Collinsville High School, now takes classes at Southwestern Illinois College, which is based in Belleville. Emily, thanks for joining us on the 21st.
Thanks. So I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, no, it's good to talk to you. No, I mean, you're 16 years old, right? You're going for your associate's degree, hopefully by next year, you know, when you're 17. Well, why was this program a good fit for you?
For me, I saw it as a head start because I knew that with the field that I want to go into, it's going to take a lot of schooling. So I thought this as a way to be like, if I can get 2 years of college out of the way while I'm still in high school, like, that's just perfect for me.
Yeah, but so you mentioned the field you're going into. What field is that? What are you studying?
I want to go into medical research, so basically go all the way to get my PhD. So it's going to take quite a bit of schooling.
You have plenty of school ahead of you. There's no why not get started now? So how does this work? Can you kind of take us inside? I mean, you're taking classes at high school and then go to college, or how does the program work?
So all Running Start students are full-time college students. So we have a full-time college schedule. We have to take a minimum of 16 credit hours a semester. But we're still allowed to participate in all of the clubs and activities at the high school. So like me, I'm still a part of like STEM club, student council, health occupation, Students of America at the high school.
So physically then classes, do you take any classes at the high school, or is it just the social stuff in the after school?
Just the social stuff. We don't take any academic courses at the high school.
Okay, so you're really, you are a college student right now then, it sounds like, pretty much.
Exactly, yep.
Nice. Well, I want to bring another voice into this conversation. Nancy Leivald is on the line with us from Southwestern Illinois College. She's executive director at the community college's Granite City and Redbud campuses, where the school started its Running Start program back in 2012, I think. Welcome to the show, Nancy. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you, and we look forward to sharing information with you and your listeners about our program.
Yeah, no, it sounds like a great program here. I mean, how many students are currently enrolled in Running Start?
As we wrap up our registration for this coming year, we currently today have 326.
The program's been going since 2012?
Yes, we started with a pilot group of 10 in 2012 and one high school district.
It sounds like it's going well.
Yes, because we now have 18 partner high school districts and the total of the 326 students participating.
Okay, so there's specific partner schools, and so who's eligible? Who can take part in this program?
Well, some high schools offer the program for 1 year or 2 years. So, of course, if you're participating in the one-year program as a senior, you're not going to be earning your associates, but you will be earning college credit, which mm-hmm. is transferable. So each school district does set their criteria, and typically it's based upon a GPA requirement, completion of some English and math courses, such as geometry, and then you also have to take a college readiness exam known as ACCUPLACER.
Okay. And why, for Southwestern Illinois, why was this good for you? Why just decide to start the program?
One, we know that for many students, and as Emily's already talked about, they want to get a jump start on college. Some students we hear, they're just kind of, they don't feel they're being challenged at their high school as much as they would like, or they maybe just don't feel they fit into some of the social environment and they're ready to just move on. So we felt that we could help fill that need for a select group of students.
And, you know, Emily talked about her specific field and being in school for many years and sort of getting a jump start on that. You referenced there. I mean, I could see, you know, cost being a benefit. There's a lot of other reasons here, I suppose. But what are you here? What are some of the main reasons that people sign up for the program?
Cost.
That's a big reason.
And, of course, as Emily stated, the majority of our students are like Emily. They're going into career paths that are going to require more than a traditional four-year bachelor's degree. Yeah. So many of them are going into medical, dental, pharmaceutical, law, engineering, fields that are going to require more. And so I've even had students that have said, our parents have set aside X amount of dollars for our college education. And if I can save money in my first 2 years in my gen eds, it's just going to allow me to have more money for when I get into my defined field.
And in terms of the tuition that they're paying, so technically still in those high school years, but going to college and taking the college courses for the last year or the last 2 years there, how does tuition work? Do they pay normal tuition at the school there?
Yes, we as opposed to the traditional student pays according to the number of hours and the classes that they take, where we have, as Emily stated, it's minimum of 16 hours. We do have some students who take 18 to 20. They take an overload schedule, but we charge a flat rate, which includes the tuition and fees. So if you're into classes that have a lot in the science and math with additional fees, you're going to save more money than if you're possibly in just some of the liberal arts classes.
Okay, Emily, I mean, is that part of your calculation too here? I mean, the financial benefits, if you're looking forward to that many years in school, that's a lot of money that piles up. Student loans are obviously a big issue on people's minds right now. Is that a cost of concern for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, now that I'm looking at applying to colleges, it's like, wow, college is so expensive. So knowing that I'm saving 2 years of full-time college, like this is, it's really going to help.
Nice. And in terms of the workload and things, so you are, you know, you're going to get the 2 degrees simultaneously there. You're in college now all the time. Is it a manageable workload? Do you feel like you're, you know, sort of studying all the time compared to people who are still going to Collinsville High School?
For me, I definitely see that I study more because all of your grades are mainly tests, or at least for the teachers that I've had. You just take tests all the time, so you are constantly studying. But I'm capable of it, and I think it's great. So,
Nancy, just what types of things have you been hearing from parents about the program?
Most parents are very happy with the program. They're very happy with the cost savings. And a lot of students say that their parents had a particular college budget, and they know that by saving money early on, they're going to have more money for when they move to those advanced degrees. I've had the parent who's came back and said to me that it was great to have their child start college and have that experience while they were at home and while the parent could still monitor and stay on top of things, so that when they did go away to school, they were really only adjusting to that housing situation. They already had adjusted to the college life. And so parents found that really beneficial, because for many 18-year-olds, they go away to college and they've never been anywhere but home.
It's a lot of adjustment all at once. So you're saying there's a big advantage there, potentially, at least in some cases, from parents who are saying that you can kind of divide that up a little bit to make the adjustments a little bit smoother.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, Emily, we talked earlier about some of the clubs and stuff. So you're still in the high school in terms of some of the after school and extracurricular things. What things do you do? What do you come back to school for? What are some of the clubs and the organizations you're a part of?
I'm a part of Health Occupation Students of America, also known as HOSA, and I was vice president of that last year. So this is a club for students who are interested in going to the health career field. They can be a part of that. I'm in STEM club, science, technology, engineering, math, and I'm vice president of that this year. I'm in student council, Latin club, some of the honor societies there, such as National Honor Society and Science National Honor Society.
You have a full load there. And then are you also able to do clubs and extracurricular activities at the college?
Yes. And I do the College Activities Board, where we like help plan events for students on campus. I'm a part of that, as well as Phi Theta Kappa.
Wow, okay. And Nancy, sort of thinking about all these different outlets and things that students can get involved in, you know, you mentioned before sort of the social aspects of it too. So, Nancy, what kinds of programs or assistance do you provide for students who are making that adjustment from a high school, you know, at a young age and younger than some of the peers in terms of who's at college, to sort of help that adjustment happen in the best way possible?
Well, one of the things that we do, of course, each of these students are assigned an academic advisor. So this allows them to meet with the same person to plan their courses for the full 2 years. And so that's a real benefit, because you have that stability. We also, the Running Start staff, meet with students at least 3 times each semester. One of those is typically a group session, and in that group session, we might work on things such as how you complete college applications, compiling a scholarship resume, test-taking strategies, note-taking skills, even sessions covering plagiarism. And so some of those sessions are required of the program, whereas a typical college student, they may be offered, but of course not everyone takes advantage of them.
Yeah.
So we have a little more intensive support. They always have a Running Start staff person that they could go to if they need assistance. And kind of like a high school, our instructors are asked to complete progress reports on these students at least twice each semester. So if they are having difficulty, we can immediately help them get the resources they need.
Yeah, and sort of give them an extra boost there. Does it ever happen, or is it possible that somebody could start in the program and say, you know what, this really isn't for me. Actually, I want to sort of go back to just finishing up and focusing on high school right now.
When I look back to the pilot group that started, there were 10 in 2012 that started in the pilot group from the Granite City School District, and there were 2 of those students that left and returned to their high school. And that, it's sometimes for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's because college just wasn't what they expected or thought it was going to be. Sometimes it's because they miss their friends. And, of course, as you can hear from Emily, she still stays in touch with her friends and stays very involved. But, of course, that takes some planning and scheduling on her part to make all of that work.
Yeah, to balance all that. And I'm also thinking here, too, of the parents. You know, so this is also an adjustment not only for students but for the parents there. And to think, okay, you know, after the second year of high school, okay, my student now is really effectively in college. You know, how does that work? What does that interaction look like? How do you bring and communicate with the parents through this process?
When you participate in this program, we do sign, all participants sign a permission and release form, which allows us full disclosure with parents and their high school staff. So typically, if you recall back to your college days, once you went to college, your professors and the college no longer could talk with your parents because of rights of privacy. But that is one of the things that everyone agrees to in the very beginning, so that we have the opportunity for full disclosure.
And Emily, how's that been for you? I mean, your parents been a part of the process, obviously, and been allies in this, and the communication and things that flow in back and forth. They've been supportive of this?
Oh, yeah. My mom is all for this program, and she actually tells me all the time how much she appreciates that Ms. LaVault and all of her staff emails, because she's always telling me, I'm so glad that they're emailing us and keeping us up to date on what's going on. And that's one of her big things. She loves the communication that the Running Start staff has with us.
And thinking about the types of students, you know, I mean, you going from a high school to a college, there's always, you tend to experience more diverse groups of people. There's more age groups, more people from different areas, different parts of the country, different parts of the world. Has that experience been different? Have you noticed that in terms of the people who are in your classes who you're now studying with? Has that expanded things a bit for you?
It has expanded because I've had classes with people who are full-time parents and work full-time and kids who are 16 like me. So there's definitely a huge variety there. But I love diversity, so I'm all about it. I thought it was great.
And how do your friends, when you talk sort of and describe what you're experiencing and some of the, I mean, it sounds fantastic and very cool, frankly, sort of with what you're able to do here and both at the same time and still be a part of the social scene at the high school and at the college. What do your friends say? How do they look on this? Are they envious, I guess, of some of what you're being able to do, or how's that working?
Some of my older friends were, because they didn't have the program at Collinsville whenever they were there. But they know that I'm a very independent person, so they're like, this is great for you because you're able to do how you please and be able to take the classes that I want to and need to. So they're all very supportive with it.
Yeah, the group right around you. Nancy, I should tell people, we're talking right now about a program called Running Start. It allows students in the last year or last 2 years, as is Emily's case here, to take college courses, to enroll in college, to graduate much sooner than potentially from high school and with an associate's degree at the same time. Nancy Liebwald, Executive Director of Southwestern Illinois College's Granite City and Redbud campuses. Emily Larner, one of the students who's taking part in the program there through Southwestern Illinois College. Nancy, coming back to you for a minute, the Running Start students, how do they compare academically, I guess, to other college students at your school who might be more of the 18 and 19-year-olds?
Well, if you're asking for data, we typically do not take that test data and compare them, but many of our instructors place them at the top of the students in their class. A lot of them have told us that they really like some of the challenges and the questioning and the insight that they bring to their classes. And so they've been very happy to add that segment of the population into their coursework.
And when students come in, I mean, I know I think I went through two or three majors before I finally realized kind of where I was supposed to be in this world when I was in college and taking that time. And, you know, Emily, first of all, sounds a whole lot more mature than I was at that age. But when you have students who are coming in and sort of navigating some of this terrain, how is this program, and I guess Southwestern Illinois College in general, supporting students and sort of helping to figure out these things?
And you're right, that does happen. We've had some students who were pursuing the Associate of Science, and as they've started working on that program, they've got in and they found out that they really don't like a lot of the science and math classes that they're in, and so they transition over to the Associate of Arts program. So it does allow them that flexibility to experience some different curriculums. And the benefit of this program, between your junior and senior year, you can take up to 10 hours in the summer. So let's say you take two classes, math and science, you decide that's not the field for you. You have the opportunity to kind of catch up by going in that summer between junior and senior year and still be on track to graduate with your associates.
And Nancy, just thinking about the program and all that you've laid out here and described, I mean, do you think as more students hear of this, and you know, this is modeled after similar programs, primarily out west, I understand, things have become more common, like we see some things from AP classes? Will this be a path that opens to more students?
Well, I think that you're always going to have the AP and dual credit classes, because not all students are going to be the right fit for this particular type of program, because as I mentioned, you do have to demonstrate college readiness in both English and math, and there's always those students that maybe excel in just one area or the other, and so the AP and dual credit offers an opportunity for them in their specific skill set.
And Emily, I mean, is this something you recommend to other people? If folks are listening right now and they may be in one of these schools that is a part of the program, or maybe could be at some point, would you say this is a program that's right for folks like you?
Oh, yeah, I definitely would recommend it to anyone who feels that maybe high school isn't challenging enough for them, or they're just ready for something new. I completely recommend it. It's helping me get prepared for college and just experience new things at a younger age.
That's the voice of Emily Larner, student now through the Running Start program at Southwestern Illinois College. Also talking with Nancy Liebwald, Executive Director of Southwestern Illinois College's Granite City and Redbud campuses. The program is called Running Start. It's been going on since 2012. Sounds like it's just getting bigger and better every year. Nancy and Emily, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today.
Thank you very much, Scott.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
It's the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. You know, this is an interesting moment for a lot of reasons, but especially to be a comedian, and especially a comedian who likes a good political joke. Saturday Night Live has rebounded into cultural relevance. John Oliver, Stephen Colbert, Trevor Noah, they're all kind of taking on big cultural and political issues at this moment. Comedy and politics, obviously, have long been tied together. In some cases, seem almost inseparable. It's one recent example here. Jeremy McClellan, he's a comedian based in Charleston, South Carolina, won the Charleston stand-up comedy competition 2 years running in 2015 and 2016. Jeremy, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So it's tough to label performers, maybe especially so in your case. You know, so you're a white Christian guy from the South, a large following of young Muslims in North America. You focus a lot of your comedy on politics, on political issues. How do you describe the comedy you do?
Well, I mean, I think comedy in general is just all about the ridiculousness of human attempts to like control reality and to understand reality. And so anytime there's a mismatch between the two, it's funny. Like, I mean, even just, you know, basic jokes about like puns, it's just like, okay, so our language is an attempt to, you know, to describe reality, but language can mean a bunch of things. So like, that's inherently funny. And so politics is definitely a huge, and culture and society and all these, you know, big issues. Those are all inherently ridiculous because people, you know, you're not able, you know, politicians, you're not actually able to get what you want done. Because you're trying to control so many people and you're trying to control so many different things. Especially I think if you're Donald Trump and your entire idea is to make America great again and to make America be a certain way, despite actual Americans you know, not following along.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've been doing this now. I think you said your first stand-up gig was about 4 years ago.
Right.
How has your comedy and the jokes you tell and the reaction to it changed since what we saw, you know, throughout 2016 and then after the election too?
Right. You know, I've always been doing the same types of comedy about politics, about politicians, about foreign policy and immigration and civil liberties and those types of issues. You know, religion has always been something that's really important to me and also something that I like to joke about. And so I've been doing that for, you know, ever since I started. What has happened is that in the last year and a half, people have become very, very thirsty for that kind of comedy. And I mean, especially, you know, as it relates to Trump, I was saying the exact same things about Obama, you know, when he was running, but people didn't necessarily want to hear that as much. So I don't think that my material has changed an awful lot. But, you know, as much as I've grown in the last year and, you know, been able to do this full time and to get so many gigs, I think that is an expression of people's desire to have comedians point out the absurdity of politics, because, you know, comedians are not experts in, you know, public policy or economics or whatever. We're not actually experts, but we are experts in the absurdity of those endeavors and of politics in general. And so I think people feel like we are in a very, very absurd point in time when, you know, there's so many ham-fisted government ways, and just, you know, society in general is getting very you know, it feels like it's getting more ridiculous.
So comedy as cultural anthropology, you know, sort of dissecting the moment and kind of seeing where, I mean, you touched on some of these issues. You mentioned, you know, comedians. I mean, like, I'm certainly not an expert in public policy and things like that, but there are people out there who are saying, what do you make of this? Who might argue that, you know, hey, a comedian, just be funny. Just make us laugh. You know, quit talking about politics.
Yeah, but laughter is, right. I mean, people say that. And usually it's because they disagree with your politics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, no one is like, I really agree with you, but just stick to being funny. And it's like, okay, but how I am funny is pointing out the absurdities in politics and, you know, these big hot button issues. So, you know, and it's true that when people go and, you know, some people, when they go and see a comedy show, that like they just want to hear jokes about hats or something like that, you know, mm-hmm. you know, silly stuff. But, you know, even jokes about hats, like even that is going to be about the absurdities of us trying to understand the world and us trying to make sense of it, which is, you know, there's always going to be a tension in how we try to control the world. And so I think that, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Yeah, well, and comedy has long filled that kind of space, that tension mm-hmm. and pointing out that absurdity.
Yeah, I mean, when has comedy ever not been political? I don't know what this, you know, even just going back to like the earliest, it's like, well, it's court jesters, like mm-hmm. next to the king. So I don't understand why. But people, I guess, if you make a joke and they feel like it's at their expense, they feel like you're making fun of their favorite politician, they will get mad and be like, you know, just stick to comedy. And you're like, I am. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, see, it feels like you walk a lot of lines, right, as a comedian, mm-hmm. especially as, you know, who you are, doing jokes about politics, about race, about Muslims, about Islamophobia. I mean, how mm-hmm. do you navigate? Do you feel like you're constantly navigating these lines between being funny and something else?
Yeah, but I think, I mean, again, I think that being funny is inherently subversive of those kind of constructs. And so, you know, it's not as if, like, I'm being funny about something and then I'm like, but seriously, everyone. And then I give a, you know, a speech about, you know, how we should all come together or some you know,
right,
something like that. Yeah, so for me, there's not a big line between comedy and all the serious stuff that I do.
Mm-hmm.
It's all just pointing out the ridiculousness of those attempts. But it is tricky trying to find a line between, you know, how to navigate all those subjects in a way that people like. I mean, that's always tricky.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's play one. We've talked a lot about your comedy, and I, you know, there's nothing worse than saying, hey, be funny in the moment here. But we do have mm-hmm. a clip here that we pulled off of, I think it was off of your Facebook page. Let's just hear a moment here from one of your recent performances.
The other day we got into an argument because she was saying that women still make 77 cents for every dollar that a man makes, right? But like I explained to her, that's just because men naturally gravitate towards higher paying professions, like doctor or engineer or CEO, whereas women, this is true, just naturally gravitate towards lower paying professions, like female doctor and female engineer and female CEO. It's not our fault you don't apply for the regular jobs. Turn the application over. It's all right there. Fine print. I think men should make more than women. I do. You know why? Because we provide for women, right? We end up... Hold on. We end up sharing all that extra money with our wives and our daughters to take care of them, which can get really expensive because I don't know if you guys know this, but they only make like 77 cents for every dollar that a man makes. So like, if anything, we should be getting a raise just to make up for all the sexism women experience in the workplace.
I wasn't quite sure there at first where you were going with that. So, there, you know, we talked about kind
of
that tension and the absurdity.
Well, yeah,
it's a little uncomfortable, right, in that moment. I mean, is that kind of representative of your approach there?
That's the point. So a lot of times people come up to me after the show and they like, you know, like, or they hear that joke and they want to know, what do you think about the wage gap, right? They want to
mm-hmm.
know, what's your opinion on, like, do women really make less or is it the actual same jobs? And that completely misses the point of it, because what they're trying to do is they're trying to translate a joke into prose and then judge that, like, into, like, you know, some opinion, like, you know, a sort of like reverse engineer the joke into a statement. And then do they agree or disagree with that statement, when really the point of that joke is to make women in the audience mad and then happy and then mad and then happy and then mad and then happy. And that's fun. You know, sort of knock you off your feet and, you know, sort of use bad logic and kind of like that to me that's inherently funny.
And playing off of who you are, too. I mean, that joke would be very different coming from a woman, but here you are a guy and a white guy standing on stage making that joke. And there's a whole different tension there.
Right. But it's about the effect that you have on the audience. And so what I think. And I do that with like any subject. So like any subject that comes up, You know, I find the absurdity. I find some like weird logic I can apply to it, and that's funny. So it's not necessarily like, okay, I want my audience to think a certain thing about the wage gap. So how do I tell a joke that makes them think that? Like, I think that's sort of using comedy as propaganda, and I don't think that's necessarily a good thing.
I mean, obviously the point of comedy is to make people laugh. I can see that. We heard that there, and I mean, I felt that there and that during that joke. You know, looking sort of at the way you're using social media now, the commentary, sort of the cultural mm-hmm. critique that we see right now that you're working on as well, not when you're not right. on stage even. You know, it seems like you're mm-hmm. – how has that evolved for you? Are you trying to do more now to make people laugh? Are you trying to spark more of a – is there something bigger that you're trying to do right now?
Well, yeah. I mean, I do have opinions about American foreign policy and immigration and things like that. And I do think these are questions that need to be addressed. And for me, it's like, okay, well, what's my role? So, like, I'm not an expert on immigration. I don't, like, have – I mean, I don't work for a think tank. But – I do find these types of issues ridiculous, and you're sort of our attempts to make reality the way that we want it to make America the way we want it to, sort of like, you know, it's a very conceited way of trying to organize society. And so I do want to draw attention to those things. I do have opinions, and if it's on social media, I'll put my opinion out there. That's fine. When I'm on stage, it's just jokes. So there is sort of a difference between coming and seeing a show where, like, hopefully everything I say is funny versus, like, just my opinions on social media. But, I mean, I definitely have opinions that I'm not afraid to share.
So this coming weekend you'll be in Illinois. You're part of the Muslim Students Association Spring Conference here at the mm-hmm. University of Illinois. That's a common type of a venue for you across the country. You know, you have thousands of fans,
right.
And tens of thousands of fans on social media. Many of them mm-hmm. are Muslim across North America. Both, mm-hmm. you know, did you set out specifically to reach a Muslim audience, or how did that grow?
No. Well, I mean, I was saying all the things that I normally say, and that I have been saying for years. And then about a year and a half ago, all the stuff that I was saying just started sort of going viral within the Muslim community. And I had some high-profile people, like this guy Yasir Qadhi, who shared my page and told people to like it. And so that's, you know, things like that. And then I got booked for some, you know, some events that were Muslim, and they went well, and word travels fast within the Muslim community. And so it just sort of organically grew from there. But the things that I'm saying now are the same things that I was saying 2 years ago when I had Muslim friends. But I didn't have, you know, like a ton of Muslim fans.
Mm-hmm. So thinking about sort of your trajectory, and, you know, you won the competition in Charleston there 2 years
sure.
in a row, and I'm growing, and now you're touring nationally and all these things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is the logical progression for comedians and entertainers and performers in general is kind of you keep going to bigger and bigger stages. Is that something you're looking for? Or what's the space that you ultimately want to be in? Do you know?
You know, there's no I think there used to be a logical progression among comics where and there still is to an extent. So, like, you perform at bigger venues, and then, like, you know, you go on Conan, and, you know, there's this very logical progression. You release albums, and there's this, you know, I think, and that was the way that you made it as a stand-up comedian.
Or you go on public radio, and hey, you know, that's.
Yeah, absolutely. This is my big shot. So that was the normal progression. Now you can do it however you want. So, like, I skipped a lot of stuff by, you know, getting big on social media. Like, Bo Burnham went from YouTube videos to, like, a Comedy Central special, like, really fast because he was huge on YouTube. And so I think social media and all these other, you know, other ways of connecting directly with fans. Because, like, I don't even know how they used to do it in the old day, where they, like, toured, and then they were like, okay, well, like, you know, just I may be here in a month, and, like, so yeah, I may come back to this, you know, this city, so come and see me then, like, you know, join
sell
my
some
mailing
CDs
list. Like,
and join a mailing list.
That would have been so, you know, I think now is, like, a really exciting time to be a comic where you can reach people directly, and you don't have to go through all these other mediating institutions. But, you know, obviously, you know, bigger and better things. But a year ago, I wouldn't have planned this past year. I wouldn't have been able to plan it. So I'm just sort of going with the flow and riding the wave.
Jeremy McClellan, comedian based there in Charleston, South Carolina. Jeremy, thank you very much.
Great.
I appreciate you talking to us.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back. That's all the time we have here today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st. Also available on iTunes and Android if you have Alexa. Easy to find there. Just tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st if you have that enabled. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us by phone, email, social media, that's all at our website, 21stshow.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for The 21st Show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis, background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us there. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want to ask us on air. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecilio, and Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction engineering support comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Scott Cameron. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.